want to be alone. I just want to be alone.
You want to be alone, comrade?
No.
Yes, quote, unquote, another edition of the quizzical quotation game devised and introduced by Nigel Rees.
Hello again. Well, Ronald Fletcher and I are here again to lob quotations at a team consisting this week of Richard Boston, Benny Green, Lord Mancroft and Polly Toynbee. And we'll start you off with some nice, easy catchphrases. Lord Mancroft, you might not think that this was a catchphrase at all, but it was a little while back. A certain character, if a drink was so much as hinted at, would always arrive in time to say,
I don't mind if I do.
Jack Train, Colonel Chinstrap in Itmar.
Yes, two marks. And here he is in action.
Now listen, Pump's coming to stay here, so we better watch out for him. He's a sly, Jerry.
Did I hear you say dry sherry, Henley?
Yeah.
I don't mind if they do.
Well, if it isn't the walking wine list. I say, Colonel, what'll you do when the war's over?
I'm going to get lit up when the lights go up in London.
Ah, I seem to have heard that sort of sentiment.
What? I'll be feeling doubly frisky.
Did you say a double whiskey?
My dear sir, when the peace breaks out, I'll drink the Bay of Biscay.
That certainly will be a marvellous occasion.
I'll get lit up, and so I think will you.
Toot-toot.
I'll be pickled as a parrot.
Well, what about a glass of claret?
Well, thank you, sir. I don't mind if I do.
Jack Train and Tommy Handby. Do you remember that, sir? Oh, my God.
Very well indeed. It used to stop the whole war out in Normandy because the Germans got to know that Itmar came over at 9 o'clock on a Thursday, and that was a safe time to launch an attack. That is true, because nobody would go to battle on Thursday at 9 o'clock, and they had to reorganize the whole of the program from the BBC to stop this happening. Such was the love and affection which we had for Itmar.
And it'd be interesting to know, I mean, it's one of those phrases, I don't mind if I do, whether the show put it in the language or whether the show took it out of the language.
Oh, well, there were plenty in that lovely show, yes. May I do you now, sir, Mrs. Mopp, do you remember? Oh, lovely one.
That's right. Well, Richard Boston, another catchphrase for you. It's associated with a certain actor, whatever role he happens to be playing.
Oh, calamity.
It's not Sir Laurence Olivier.
No.
is it James Robertson Justice?
No.
It's Robertson Hare, I think.
Robertson Hare, in all the parts.
Robertson Hare, and even he doesn't remember which particular Aldwych farce he first said it in. Polly Toynbee, very recent catchphrase, this, two words.
I'm free.
Oh, it's Mrs. Somebody or other, and are you being served?
Well, did you say Mrs.?
Miss Somebody, it's the older
Freudian
one, the middle-aged.
Slip there, I think.
Oh, no, it's not. It's are you free? It's the man who runs the shop floor, who wears a carnation in his, in his lapel.
No, the audience is shouting at you. It's John Inman who plays the character Mr. Humphreys.
Oh, the camp one, yes.
Yes, and he's even got it into a song.
Grace Brothers, Men's Department.
Mr. Humphreys, are you free?
I'm free.
Forward, please.
Mind the door.
What?
Are you being served, sir?
I'm Humphreys, and I'm free.
Are you being served, sir?
What would you like to see?
Strange how the simplest of phrases catch on. Benny Green, one of the earliest radio catchphrases.
The day war broke out.
Oh, yeah. Rob Wilton.
Yes.
My favourite line in all Rob Wilton's career was when he's running the fire station, and a phone call comes through the fire, and he said, keep it going till we get there.
Also, of course, Peter Cook in Beyond the Fringe. That was his great catchphrase, one of his famous
sketches. He probably picked it up from Rob Wilton. Anyway, now some more general quotations. Talking of the day war broke out, Lord Mancroft will make you think of the gentleman whose voice you're about to hear. Who is he? When was he speaking? And what was he quoting?
Out of this nettle danger, we pluck this flower, safety.
It's Shakespeare originally, but it's not Shakespeare speaking, no.
He tended not to get applause for his quotations.
sounds like Neville Chamberlain, I'm afraid, doesn't it?
Yes. Can you remember the occasion here?
Yes, I'm afraid it's coming back from the Munich agreement and waving that piece of paper with Alec Douglas Hume standing just behind him at the aircraft.
Well, I'll give you your mark. In fact, he was on his way to Munich. He said it as he set off. He said that he hoped to be able to say this when he came back. Which he did in a manner of speaking, or not. That quotation came, as you said, from Shakespeare. Do you know the play?
Henry V, is it?
Henry IV, Part I, and it was said by Hotspur. Out of this nettle danger we pluck this flower, safety. Richard Boston, when T.S. Eliot described Macabre the mystery cat as...
the Napoleon of crime.
He was echoing whom?
Was it G.K. Chesterton, the Napoleon of Notting Hill? But that's not it. The Napoleon of crime.
Benny Green wants to say.
It must be Moriarty in Sherlock Holmes, yes?
Yes, yes. In the final problem, yes. Conan Doyle describes Professor Moriarty as the Napoleon of crime. Polly Toynbee, who referred to whom as...
an effete corps of impudent snobs.
And as...
the nattering nabobs of negativism.
Somebody flamboyant in Parliament fairly recently...
Fairly recently, but...
not in Parliament. Oh,
perhaps Congress rather than Parliament.
Oh, Congress.
Oh, yes.
Yes, of course, it was Agnew.
Yes. About whom did he say it? Spiro Agnew, the former Vice President of the United States.
Oh, about anybody nice, sort of lefties, liberals, decent people generally.
Well, a particular group
Campus
of...
Campus funds, was it?
Was it the draft dodgers?
No, in fact, it was the media in general.
I said it was somebody nice.
And if he wasn't talking about the House of Lords, I think, on horrible moments.
A celebrated attack he made on the media for not agreeing that he and President Nixon were as wonderful as they thought they were. Benny Green, who wrote this?
I was photographed and interviewed and photographed again. In the street, in the park, in my dressing room, at my piano, with my dear old mother... without my dear old mother, and on one occasion sitting up in an over-elaborate bed, looking like a heavily doped Chinese illusionist.
No coward.
Yes, two marks. Lord Bancroft, did you ever encounter cowards?
Yes, one, and it's not repeatable in mixed company, unfortunately.
I was like the story. Women used to come out to him after shows and say, oh, Mr. Coward, you don't know me. And he would say, but of course I do, and how is Mabel? Well, back to Lord Bancroft. To whom was affixed the title?
Public Stomach Number One.
Slim Postgate?
Yes, the founder of the Good Food Guide.
Good Food Guide.
And upon what phrase was that title based?
Public Enemy Number One.
Yes, which was a phrase...
El Capone.
It was a phrase dreamt up by the president of the Chicago Crime Commission to dispel the romantic aura which had been put around gangsters like Capone by the press. Richard Boston, of what are these the first words?
It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13.
Goodness me. Well, the only thing I can think of with the clocks doing funny things, isn't there a story by Thurber?
The 13 clocks.
Is that what I'm thinking of? That doesn't sound quite right.
No, something more serious than that. By an English writer. Opening words.
That narrows the field down, isn't it?
It's not A.P. Herbert, is it?
No.
Because he once made a very funny remark about clocks that struck 13.
Aren't you going to tell us it?
He said that when a clock strikes 13, not only do you know it's wrong now, but you have a suspicion it's never ever been right before. But the quotation you just read out sounded suspiciously like Dickens.
No, I have to tell you, they're the opening words of 1984 by George Orwell. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Polly Toynbee, another political phrase or two for you.
It is the unacceptable face of capitalism, but one should not suggest that the whole of British industry consists of practices of this kind.
I think you probably know who said that.
Ted Heath.
Yes. What was the occasion?
Talking about a scandal in the city, which was before Slater Walker. I remember.
It was Tiny Rowland, the Londoner scandal.
Yes.
Can you tell me the year?
Yeah, it was about 4 years ago, and it was a very misconceived phrase. It wasn't quite what he meant to say.
What did he mean to say?
He said, capitalism has many faces, and it has one undesirable one, and this is it.
Yeah.
It is not quite what he said.
May 1973 was when he said it in the House of Commons, Edward Heath speaking about the Lonro affair. Benny Green, finally in this round, listen to this music and see if it encourages you to think of a printed notice somebody rather special saw hanging in a saloon bar in America.
I'm so glad you asked me that, because it's my favourite piece of musical criticism. It's the most compassionate thing any critic ever said. Oscar Wilde saw it in a saloon in the Middle West, and the sign read, "Don't shoot the pianist, he's doing his best."
Yeah. You'll have to tell me how you deduced that from hearing the piece of music.
Well, when you play me an indifferent pianist on a quotation programme, on which Oscar Wilde hasn't so far appeared, it must be that.
Piece of music
is... It's the name of the film. It's the name of the film, which
well,
appears.
Yes, T.A.C. La Pianiste by Truffaut, and that is the American version called Shoot the Piano Player.
With,
but,
as before.
Yes.
I can only think of one pianist who actually was shot while playing, and that was Pinetop Smith, wasn't it?
Well, by accident. They were aiming at somebody else.
But I'm sure you can supply many more pianists who've been... Pinetop Smith was genuinely shot, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. I can supply the names of lots of pianists who deserve to be shot. Not quite the same thing.
It's rather extraordinary visit which Oscar Wilde played to Leadville, which is in the Rocky Mountains. He talked to the miners about Benvenuto Cellini, and they were most impressed. They'd never heard about this man before, and they said, why hadn't he brought him along? And Oscar Wilde pointed out that in fact Benvenuto Cellini was dead, and the miner asked, who shot him? Now, this is the point in the game where I allow the panel to open their quotation books and invite them to suggest the quotations they would choose this week to embellish a menu or wine list. The best menus and wine lists don't need embellishment. That doesn't stop people from trying. Lord Bancroft, have you chosen a dish
yes.
or a drink?
Well, everybody knows Thurber's famous one about the naive domestic Burgundy without any breeding, but I think he'll be amused by its presumption. And that would do well on any menu. This one I don't think appears in any quotation book, because I heard it personally said by Stephen Potter, who invented lifemanship and gamesmanship and one-upmanship, and we were dining with him in his house in St. John's Wood very shortly before he died, and he gave us a bottle of port which was clearly past its best. He admitted that. And he referred, and I remember the words well, to the imperial decay of his Coburn 97, its gracious withdrawal from perfection, keeping a hint of former majesty withal, as it hovered between oblivion and the divine Untergang of infinite recession.
And he'd been rehearsing.
Was he trying to say any port in a storm? I rather
Richard Boston.
Well, I don't know. Actually, I was in a restaurant once years ago in the Caledonian Road, where they had on the menu the words "dreaded veal cutlet," but I didn't have the nerve to order it. But I was in a restaurant in Rome on one occasion, and they very helpfully had the menu in Italian and in English. And one of the items in English was frightened eggs, which rather intrigued me, but I continued to cast my eye down the menu and saw later on what was described as larks in the spit. And so the menu worked its way to the climax of tarts of the house at pleasure.
Polly Toymy, can you match that?
Well, I don't know if I can match that, but I'm not much of a fan of German food, and looking through the dictionary of quotations desperately for something to say, I found something that I thought might well be appended to the hors d'oeuvre part of the menu, which was, cheer up, the worst is yet to come.
Benny Green.
Well, I don't know. I did know somebody once who thought that Beef Stroganoff was the Hungarian wrestling champion. But the thing that I've always wanted to see on a menu is the quotation next to the apple pie. And a quotation goes, age cannot wither it, nor custard stale.
Ronnie Fletcher, you're treasuring another description of wine, which is an actual one, which was in a wine catalogue.
Yeah, this is another sample of the incredible way people write about it. It's in, it was a bottle of Nuit Saint-Georges, 64. Deep colour and big, shaggy nose. Rather a jumbly, untidy sort of wine, with fruitiness shooting off one way, firmness another, and body pushing about underneath. It will be as comfortable and comforting as the 1961 Nuit Saint-Georges, when it has pulled its ends in and settled down.
And if you can follow that, you can follow anything. I once heard of an Armagnac brandy being described as having the smell of a damp dog. I think it'll put you off anything. Incidentally, if listening at home you'd like to contribute anything on this subject, we'd be glad to hear from you. We've been overwhelmed at the response to our request at the beginning of the series for you to let us have your favourite quotations. We're still sorting through them, but they tend to fall into three categories. First, quotes from quotation books, like the one from Ralph Waldo Emerson that is the choice of Mrs. Duncan Beardmore Gray of Wokingham.
The louder he talked of his honour, the faster we counted our spoons.
Then there are the quotations, which, as far as I know, haven't made the quotation books yet, but are still nevertheless worth being told about. Commander E.D. Webb, RN of Blackheath, sent us a quote from a book called The Laughing Diplomat. Daniel Vare met Nansen and tried to draw him out on the subject of his adventures, but all Nansen would say was...
The cold of the polar regions was nothing to the chill of an English bedroom.
And then we've had a lot of family sayings, which obviously, by their very nature, don't make the quotation books, but get much quoted within the family. Jane Cliff writes from Hove in Sussex about what she heard many years ago from her two small daughters, the memory of which, she says, still makes her laugh.
Don't let's ask Mummy. She'll only say no. Let's ask Daddy.
And Mrs. Mary Collins from Cowbridge, South Glamorgan, sends us a quote from her father. She says on meeting one of the opposite sex for the first time, he would invariably inform her,
I don't know your age, madam, but you don't look it.
And Mrs. Collins adds that every woman took that as a compliment. More of your quotations later in this series. But now, back to the panel and to a round I've called Quote Misquote. I want you to tell me what's wrong with some sayings that are frequently misquoted. Lord Mancroft, have a listen to the Andrews sisters.
Money is the root of all evil. Money is the root of all evil. Won't contaminate myself with it. Take it away, take it away, take it away. La 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 la.
Money is the root of all
evil. No,
it
is the love of money that's the root of all evil.
Quite so. And where does it come from?
Faintest idea.
Well,
from the Bible, isn't it?
Yes, Richard. Do you know which book of the Bible?
Proverbs?
No, the first epistle of Paul to Timothy. The love of money is the root of all evil. Richard Boston.
The $64 question.
Is that a right or wrong?
I would have thought, even before inflation, it doesn't sound very generous. I would have thought it must be an American quiz show, which surely would be the $64,000 question.
Quite so, but it's amazing how many people, in fact, say the $64 question when they mean the question which enables you to sweep the board and the key question. So it was an American TV quiz show, which was imported over here. There were two versions of it, the $64,000 question and the $64,000 challenge. Polly Toynbee, quote or misquote?
We are the masters now.
Lord Shawcross these days says that he didn't say it, but I think he did.
He did?
He did say it, but I think he now repunctuates it. We are the masters. We are the masters. We are the masters.
And what he says he says now is we in Parliament are the masters now. What he actually said was what he said, we are the masters now. That's what the row is about.
Well, not quite. As Sir Hartley Shawcross, as he then was, in the House of Commons in April 1946, we are the masters at the moment. And not only for the moment, but for a very long time to come. It's curious how phrases just change and everybody uses them in a different way. Benny Green?
Pride girth before a fall.
Pride cometh before a fall.
Yeah.
Yes?
No?
No.
Comes from a longer phrase. Anybody?
Rides before a fall.
Now, the full sentence I'll have to give you comes from the Book of Proverbs. Pride goeth before destruction, and an haughty spirit before a fall. But for some reason it's been corrupted. Lord Bancroft?
Cast thy bread upon the waters, and it shall return to thee an hundredfold.
It shall return to thee after many days.
Yes, quite so. Do you know where it comes from?
That's the New Testament, isn't it?
I knew it's the Old Testament. Ecclesiastes. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Richard Boston, for you?
All that glitters is not gold.
All that glisters is not gold, and it's the Bard wrote the original.
It's not the Bard, sorry.
Not the Bard, no.
Anybody know who it was?
No, it's a comparative, it's a, somebody fairly obscure, I think. It's,
well, I wouldn't say terribly obscure. Thomas Gray.
Oh, Thomas Gray.
Ode on the Death.
Oh, the fish, the cat, and the, is it?
Ode on the Death of a Favourite Cat. Ronnie, yes. You've got the full quotation.
Yes. Not all that tempts your wandering eyes and heedless hearts is lawful prize. Nor all that glisters gold.
Polly Toynbee, another misquote for you.
First, catch your hare.
You may think it's a quote, but perhaps you think it's a misquote.
I haven't heard of it at all. Mrs. Beaton.
Well, you're right to home in on that lady. Usually attributed or associated with Mrs. Beaton. Do you think she actually said that?
First, catch your hare. First, jug your hair.
In fact, it was said by another...
First, cut your hair.
In fact, the phrase is, take your hair when it is cased, and it is not Mrs. Beaton at all, but an 18th century cookery lady called Hannah Glass. Ah, so no marks there, I'm afraid. Benny Green.
Like the curate's egg, it's good in parts.
Is that a quote or a misquote?
I know whatever I'm going to say, I'm going to be wrong on this. It sounds right, so I suppose it's wrong, but I don't know why.
Yes, you're right, it's wrong.
It's a misquote, because it's the caption to a Punch cartoon. The cartoon had two people talking. It said something like, how's your egg? And he said, it's good in parts, my lord. A curate speaking to a bishop, no doubt.
Yes, it's more or less it. And the Right Reverend Host, remember those old Punch captions, the Right Reverend Host says, I'm afraid you've got a bad egg, Mr. Jones, and the curate replies, oh, no, my lord, I assure you, parts of it are excellent. But anyway, we got the general drift of it. Just looking, taking a quick look at the score, Benny Green is still keeping his magnificent lead over Lord Mancroft. Well done, Benny. Well, it's not a very big jump from misquotations about curates' eggs to what we call on this programme scrambled quotations. Not misquotations, but quotations which have been deliberately tampered with. And I'd like you to tell me the original in each case. Lord Mancroft.
Brevity is the soul of lingerie.
Brevity is the soul of wit.
Yes, and where does that come from?
Nah.
Anybody?
Dorothy Parker said the second part.
Yes, Dorothy Parker scrambled it. Richard, you haven't had a guess.
Oh, what, for the original?
Yes. The source of the original.
It's the sound of wit.
It's one of those...
Shakespeare.
Yes, it was Shakespeare. Oh, yes. And if there's one play in Shakespeare which contains more quotations than anyone...
Oh, it must be Hamlet.
Yes, it was Hamlet. And for you, Richard Boston...
The money that men make lives after them.
Well, it's the reference is to Mark Antony's speech about Julius Caesar, which I'm trying to remember the words of very hard. The evil that men do lives after them. That's the reference.
Yes, it's the good.
The good is often buried with their
cause. But this is the money that men make. I should think George Bernard Shaw.
Well, don't worry who scrambles it. In fact, it was Samuel Butler, but you've got the original absolutely correct. Oh, so you get your 2 marks for that. And Polly Toynbee?
Live music is an anachronism. And now is the winter of our discotheque.
That's lovely.
What's the original there?
Richard III.
Yes, where does it come in, Richard III?
In the very beginning, prologue, when he first speaks.
And the phrase is?
Now is the winter of our discontent.
Made glorious
summer by the sun of York.
And do you happen to know who scrambled it?
I can't think.
Well, I can tell you he was sitting next to you because it was Benny Green.
Oh. He kept a very straight face.
Yes. Benny Green may just think he flings these things off, but people notice them and tuck them away. Well done, Benny. And here's the one scrambled by somebody else for you.
A bachelor never quite gets over the idea that he is a thing of beauty and a boy forever.
Well, I don't know the scrambler. The original is Keats. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its beauty fadeth never.
Yeah.
I'd love to know who the scrambler was.
A lady called Helen Rowland, of whom I've not heard before, but she did it, and it was based on Keats' Endymion.
Can I tell you the best scramble I've ever heard in my life was Thurber's. Great oaks from little acorns grow, and he changed it to a definition of Mr. Khrushchev. Great oafs from little icons grow.
I think, didn't Perelman have a piece, we had great oafs from little infants grow?
Well, finally, a look at the score, which has Benny Green with 12 points, Lord Mancroft 10, so I think perhaps a knighthood or at least a life peerage for Benny Green. And that's all for this week. For our parting shot, Ronnie Fletcher and I are going back to those restaurant quotations we were talking about earlier. Richard Monckton Milnes was a Victorian bon vivant. In other words, he used to stuff himself. And his last words are reputed to have been,
"My exit is the result of too many entrees."
Goodbye.
Taking part in quote-unquote were Richard Boston, Benny Green, Lord Mancroft and Polly Toynbee. The quotations were read by me, Ronald Fletcher. The programme was devised and introduced by Nigel Rees and produced by John Lloyd.